CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to my podcast. My name is Rosie Mutena, and of course, this is Pan African Connect, where I connect my three favorite passions in life, and that is, of course, woman, Africa, and the arts. And I'm very, very fortunate to have in studio, she's known as the rock star author. And that, of course, is Phumla Dineo-Nqola, who's an associate professor of literary, media and gender studies at the School of Literature and Language Studies at the University of Johannesburg. She's an activist. She's an author. Some of her books, which you might know, A Renegade Called Simpiwe, Rape, A South African Nightmare. And the one that we're going to be focusing on today, Reflecting Rogue. How are you?
I am great. I'm delighted to be here. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. Congratulations. You know, just for our listeners out there, Phumla launched a book, what was it, 2 weeks ago? It was just after Women's Day. In fact, yes, it was the 11th of August. And what a beautiful evening. You know, we had, I mean, when I went onto the social media space afterwards and the different levels of people that were there from different genres and the questions that we were all asking. And, you know, it's an amazing book. And I'm not just saying it because I was moderating, but it really, really is an incredibly powerful book. So congratulations.
Thank you, Rosie. And I mean, I think it really was a remarkable evening. And thank you for everything that you did to make it remarkable. Yeah. For Rosie's listeners, she was the person who that I was in conversation with that evening.
So now I'm gonna touch on some of the subjects that we spoke about at the launch, and one that still resonates with me is that the different relationships that you talk about. You know, for those who don't know, it's a group of essays that Phumla has written over the years, and you know, the one essay is about talking about your relationship that you had with your body, and this is very, very pertinent to women, because you know, a couple of days ago, I interviewed Curve Loving, the online magazine. And one of the issues that, especially as black women, is that we have this hatred for our body.
Absolutely.
You know, what was your relationship with your body growing up as, and where are you now?
Conflicted, I think. I mean, I think that we all taught, especially as girls in the world, and as black girls in the world specifically, taught to have very, at best, ambivalent, and at worst, antagonistic relationships with our bodies. So the sense of there's something wrong with your body, and your body is something that you have to rein in. So I had growing up, I liked climbing things. I was a short, chubby child and who loved climbing and who was very, I'm knock-kneed, so I'm not the most kind of graceful, lithe person, but I loved climbing. Yeah. So of course, as often as I climbed, I fell out of things. Yeah. I would climb into cupboards and up trees. Anything I could climb up, I would clamber up, and I would almost always fall. And my poor mother couldn't spend my whole childhood convinced I was going to lose an eye or crack my skull. And I have lots of bruises all over my body still. Some of them have survived. I'm not bruises now, but I mean scars. And so the sense of that many children often have, the sense of kind of freedom in your body, but also the messaging constantly that, well, girls don't climb.
Don't run too fast.
Don't run too fast. Don't climb. Don't sit like that. And I write a little bit in the book about my grandmother, Manhun, who was lovely and who was quite transgressive in many ways.
Yeah.
But one of the things that frustrated me the most about her was how I sat. And I like to sit, and I still, even as an adult, I like to sit with my knees up against my upper body.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you can imagine doesn't go down very well. It certainly didn't go down very well as a child.
Yeah.
And I like to contort. And I remember her saying to me every single time with increasing frustration, put your legs down, sit like a girl, together, cross the knees, cross the ankles, cross, you know, tidy yourself up. And so the sense of, and then of course as I grew up, as I went to school, then even more messages around something being wrong with your body. And as an older woman, then notions about, remember when we got our periods, I got my period quite early, as did two friends of mine. And the sense of this shameful thing that had happened to your body.
And you can't talk about it. It's a taboo.
Absolutely. You can't talk about it because you've done something. It's evidence of the dirty body. And then, so I feel like in many ways that I, and this is why I call one of the essays, growing into my body. I feel like I'm still growing into my body. I think I have a different kind of relationship with my body now. I'm not completely free of some of the anxieties that you get taught about your body, of course. But I mean, I have different relationship with my, I try I've tried to teach myself and to learn from other women to have a relationship with my body that isn't antagonistic. To try to think about my body as part of who I am, not just as the container of something, but as important. And so I make decisions about it that appeal to me, even if they don't make sense to other people. So when I started growing
but
locks,
that's the thing. That's the most important thing, is that all of our bodies are different. Mm-hmm. So you need to make those decisions for yourself and not worry about the next person.
Absolutely. But as you know, Rosie, that's hard, right? Because you inherit a script that says you have to have hair that's properly relaxed. And so to go bald or to grow locks when I did before they were like a hip thing to do, was met to decide to stop relaxing. And there's nothing wrong with relaxing if that's what you like, but I didn't like it. I just kind of, it was what you did when you were a girl.
Yeah.
Or to be a person, to be a black woman who in my 20s and the 90s liked tattoos and you know, to insist on getting a few and who liked piercings. And I've tried as I've grown older to invest in those things that I enjoy to do with my body.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily, you know, I don't always look the way any kind of mainstream kind of way. Yeah. And yeah, there are some mainstream things that I'm drawn to, but I've tried to kind of think about, okay, so what are we doing about this? You know, why are we shaving that? Do we like to shave that?
Yeah.
You know?
Are we comfortable with that? Is it what we want to do? Yeah. And another relationship, which, I mean, I loved the essay to your father, the letter to your father, you know, and I think all little girls, if they grow up with their fathers, always have this special, special relationship.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about that.
So I was obsessed with now as a parent, sometimes I think my poor parents. I was absolutely obsessed with my parents as a child for different reasons, and not always like in a good way. I drove them crazy. I mean, just like my poor dad had no peace of mind. I followed him around. I cried every time he tried to go anywhere.
Yeah.
I sat on his feet sometimes when he was trying to go to work and refused. And I was like, you know, he wasn't like a big man.
Yeah.
I was like this, your chubby child sitting on your feet every day. Like every day he had to go to work. Like, oh my God.
This child.
My child. It's sweet that she loves me so much, but honestly. And so but the one of the remarkable things about my dad, who didn't talk much. I mean, my mom is the big talker in the family. Was that he and I? So I went to boarding school for high school. I went to Inanda Seminary just outside Durban, from Standard 6 onwards. And my father wrote me, like my father and I wrote letters.
Yeah, wow.
So they weren't very long, but he wrote me a letter every single week. And I wrote him a letter every single week. And so we did this thing, and these letters were very kind of important. And I guess, and so I was very close to him, you know, when we were kids, he was the one that took us to school. He was the one that drove us to school. My mom was a nurse, so I mean, her schedule was a lot less flexible than his, I guess. And so he was the one who took us to school, and we didn't, you know, we were just, I don't know, children with their fathers. We talked about whatever it is that we thought was important that was probably not so interesting to him. But anyway, so my father and I had this weird relationship then from high school onwards where we wrote each other letters. And even when I was at UCT, we would, you know, until he kind of moved temporarily to Cape Town for a while. Unless we were seeing each other regularly, we were writing each other letters. And then something happened, like I think it was about, I don't know, in my teen years at some point. It was Father's Day, and I just was like, okay, I don't know what to get him. And you save your pocket money for the Mother's Day and for Father's Day, and then your dad gives you money for Mother's Day, and your dad gives. But I was like, I don't know what to get him. And all these things that people would say, get for your father. Like, he didn't like a lot of the conventional things. And I just was like, I don't know what other book to get him. I always got him a book or a CD, but he didn't really listen to the music. like a tape, you know, a tape and then a CD. So then I thought, well, I don't know what to get him, so I'm just going to write him like a letter.
Yeah.
So I wrote him this. So the kernel of that chapter is an actual letter that I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And then many, many years later, before he passed away 11 years ago, but many years ago before he died, I a friend and colleague, Kopano Ratele, said, you know, let's put together a collection on kind of blackness and pleasure and so on. And so it was initially supposed to go, that collection never happened.
Yeah.
But it was supposed to be. So then I said to my dad, okay, so I still have this letter because my dad also kept everything. He kept, we have files. I mean, he's been gone for 11 years.
Yeah.
But each one of his children had a file. He had, I mean, when, you know, I knew he kept every single school report.
Oh, wow.
Every single prize giving certificate. Mm. Every kind of random things. And they were all my letters.
Oh, wow.
And so I said to him, well, I want to include the letter, and I know it's private, but I want to change a few things.
Mm.
You know, I didn't, I should have said, is it okay? But I didn't really say, is it okay? I said, so, Gomer and I are doing this book. I'm going to update the letter. And it might be a bit weird with the added bits, but I'll keep everything that was in the original.
The essence of it, you keep it there.
Yes,
yeah.
And I'll add a few bits. And he said, okay. Mm. Like, he just, you know. And so that's the version that's in it. And it's really, I suppose, about... It's how I felt about him. Mm. It's an appreciation of the difficult decisions.
Yeah. And it's honest. And that's what I love about
it's
it.
Honest.
The
he was not a
honest.
Perfect man. He was very flawed. But it's also a reflection as I grew older of, my goodness, you know, you don't want your children. People like you, I absolutely adored my dad.
Mm.
But of course, it's like, you know, I was very aware of his flaws.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can imagine. I imagined then, because when I was revising the letter, I wasn't a parent yet. I was imagining what it might be like to know that your child is aware of some of your flaws and some of your embarrassing flaws.
Mm.
That you're human, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I suppose it's a love letter that says, you know, I know you are a human being, you are flawed, but I think it takes enormous strength to raise the kind of kids that you raise who are opinionated and affirmed and a little strange.
And
a lot strange in some cases. I'm the least strange of my siblings.
We always say that, though.
I'm the least strange.
The other ones have got problems. I'm good.
Very odd.
Yeah.
You know, and who believe in themselves. And to be able to do that, have these children who are very, very close, but also very different.
Mm. It's quite unique in the way you've been brought up.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think that happened because of your open relationship and communications with your parents, or the fact that you were exposed to a lot more than the other mainstream families?
I think probably both. I mean, I think my parents were both... were a little odd themselves, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, my mom's still odd.
Yeah.
She's getting odder as she gets older. So I think that they, I mean, there were certain things, like my dad, they definitely were not a feminist couple.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they were very far from a conventional couple. So my mom liked a lot of, so if anything broke in our house, my mom was the one who knew how to fix it.
Yeah.
Like, my dad didn't fix anything. He'd just be like, can we get someone to fix it? What's
Bring
going on?
In.
My mom would sit, and even if we got someone, she would stand. She still does it. She drives me a little crazy with this. Stands over the person going, that's not how you fix it. Why don't you put that screwdriver there, and that's the wrong nail, and take that, put that plank across. No, if you do it like this. You know, so she was that person. My dad was just like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
I don't know how to fix that.
Yeah.
And he was the one who he was an academic. So he was the one that took us to school. So he was kind of the more nerd and had to worry about the fact that every single day for about 4 years, I had a bully, which I kept secret.
Mm.
But she took my pen every morning when I got to school. So every morning, every afternoon, he would fetch me from school. I would say nothing. And every morning on our way to school, I'd say, Daddy, I need a pen.
Shame.
And he just couldn't understand this
what
child that
going
like
on?
Needed a pen every day. So he would have to kind of figure out how to get me a pen every day. Which is kind of quite nurturing, right? And normally we think that, I mean, they were both nurturing, but they were both nurturing in very different kinds of ways.
Yeah, yeah.
And my mom liked weird things. So she liked fixing things and like she knows how to fix things. I still don't know how she likes fixing things. She knows. And she was the one who was interested in things like gardens. But at the same time, she did all the kind of conventional feminine things.
Yeah,
she's
yeah,
the one
yeah.
Who
yeah. She was a mother also. But
she's
yeah.
the one who cooks. She's the one who talks to you about bodies and periods and sexual and all those things.
Mm.
And so I think that... But they spent a lot of time. We were allowed an enormous amount of room to talk.
Wow.
Right? So, and they treated us a lot like, actually, like what we had to say mattered.
Mm.
And so I think we probably over-talked.
Because you were allowed to be opinionated. Yes. Which a lot of households didn't allow.
Exactly.
And still don't allow, yeah.
Yeah. And so, but they were conventional in other respects. I mean, they didn't hit us much. Mm. My mother now, in old age, denies that they ever hit us. She
but says, they all
I think I pushed you once. Sort of. I'm like, please. You were the one that did the disciplining. He never did the disciplining. Yeah. He hit me once. Mm. Like, and it was, so, you know, they weren't strict parents by any stretch of the imagination. And they made some weird decisions. And of course, now I realize that some of them were just reverse psychology.
Yeah.
So for example, when we reached puberty, a lot of my friends' parents would want, you know, they would get into trouble for putting on makeup.
Mm.
My mom would say, come, let's see what works on you. Which is kind of nice, but also takes the fun out of it.
Yeah.
Because if everybody else is doing it because their parents don't want it. And I remember when I, you know, she said, well, if you have a boyfriend, and my first boyfriend and my sister's first boyfriends, then she'd say, yeah, but they can come visit. A boyfriend is a friend. So they must come to the house and they must visit. And I won't be in your business. You know, I mean, so you do this thing and you're sitting there now and you're like, your mom isn't in the room, but at the same time, I'm thinking now, what a smart way to make sure your kids are not having sex, are not doing anything inappropriate.
Like, come and do it, but you know I'm here.
Yes, I'm in the house. What are you going to do? You're not even going to touch. You're going to sit next to each other and talk, right? So they had these very strange ways of doing things.
Yeah.
And sometimes you were aware of how strange they were.
Yeah.
Because you knew what was, you knew how some of these things were different from what was happening in some of your friends' homes. And so I think that's where the openness comes from. Also, because they wanted to talk about, my mom was in our business all the time.
She was there.
Like, you know, and now I understand, oh, that's what that is. That was about always knowing what your children are up to.
Yeah.
And so you had the conversation about sexuality and pregnancy and all those things, but also you're watching them all the time without them realizing that that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
That it's actually, they don't have to, of course, they still rebel and they still do things behind your back eventually. But, you know, I don't know, it's measured and maybe it's delayed a little bit more and maybe it makes them feel like it's okay to have these, to talk to you about things
and
that
put things out there in the open
about.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And have you adopted that with raising your sons?
Absolutely. My partner who's a single parent himself from a different relationship, and we both have sons. He has two sons, I have two sons, and he sometimes he's just like, you talk, you do, you are in their business all the time.
Yeah.
You over talk. And he says, oh, I wish we over-talked sometimes because we, you know, I do. And sometimes, and of course, the thing is now that I'm a parent, I realize that children are lovely, but also children talk too much. Right?
And they listen now.
And they tell you every single thing. So now we do. So we talk about everything all the time. Mm. And it's fascinating when something goes wrong, of course, because it means that they are able to tell me things that sometimes can go under the radar with parenting, right? So someone says something inappropriate at school, they come and they say, do you think, does this make sense? And then you can deal with it. And I mean, and it's amazing also how young boys, and maybe girls, I don't have girls, I don't know, start talking about weird things on gender. So my 9-year-old comes home and he says, so I have a crush.
Mm. Oh, sweet.
So we're talking about the crush. And then 3 weeks later, he comes home and he says, so so-and-so has a crush on so-and-so, but so as I said, well, you know, does she like him?
Mm.
No. And then he says, but maybe she's playing hard to get. And I'm just like, okay, so now we have to like to take apart this playing hard to get thing. No, no, she's not interested. But I'm thinking, what?
Mm.
Kids are talking about these weird ideas about sexuality start that young.
Yeah, yeah.
Excuse me.
It's okay.
So yeah, I mean it's been interesting, and also just watching myself sometimes and feeling like I'm turning into my mother or I'm turning into my father, and sometimes hearing the weird statements coming out of my own mouth, going, "Did I just say that? I hated it."
And,
when
and
she
that's
said
something that you always wanted. We dreaded growing up. I was like, "I'm never going to turn into my parents," and then you do in the end.
Absolutely,
beautiful. Let's talk about the feminism. So, you know, being a feminist is not an easy life, but being a black feminist in South Africa. We've got a lot of issues to deal with. Yep. You know, the one which we spoke about at your launch is the message that the NC Women's League is putting out there, and, mm-hmm. and you know, there's a lot of hypocrisy around about that. Let's unpack those issues.
I mean, I think that they're the biggest women's organization in the country, organized women's organization in the country. And I think for a long time, and for many people, they get taken as the default spokespeople for the feminist movement.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we're starting to see all over the country different kinds of feminist articulations and movements and strategies and so on.
Mm. And different types of voices.
Different
also.
Types of voices.
Yeah.
And also disagreement, right? Which I think is great, right? We are going, because I mean, I think, you know, I think any liberation project is about risk. So I think that, I mean, of course, I think there's dangerous things that you say, and then so I've been watching, as I'm sure you have and many other people, with increasing interest how the presidential debate in the public has been playing itself out.
Yeah.
So the fact that now suddenly all the media is talking about how there are various possible women candidates, and the Women's League's previous position at some point saying we need a woman's president of the country, but we're not ready.
Yeah.
We need a president.
Are we going to push this way? Yeah.
And now suddenly this is the one we endorse.
And you mentioned somebody else's name. It's like, no, this is the only one.
Exactly. This is the one. Yeah. And now in a race where there's three other additional ones. And I think, you know, I mean, I don't think I think they're an important organization, but I think it's important for us to recognize that although they speak, they explicitly say that they're interested in gender transformation, in women's liberation and so on, in the main, they continue to articulate really conservative ideas about
very patriarchal
about how gender was, and they continue to have a very competitive and almost, well, sometimes harmful relationship to other feminist spaces. A very competitive kind of approach to, and very often kind of provide alibi for some of the most violent masculinities. I mean, they complete support of Jacob Zuma, President Zuma now, but Jacob Zuma during the trial and subsequent the presidential race and so on. I think it's really important for us. I mean, I don't think we should dismiss them. I think at the same time, though, I think it's important that we move away from this idea that they are the women's movement.
Yeah, and they're the only governing body that we need to turn to.
Absolutely.
Because there's so many other, you know, there's so many other thoughts and other avenues that we can look at. But let's talk about other African feminists or other feminists, black feminists. You know, you mentioned Alice Walker, and I only got into her reading much later on in life. Mm-hmm. And I was like, where has this woman been all my life? You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, your journey of reading on her and adoring her goes back a long, long way.
Absolutely. I mean, I'd read black women. I'd read an essay here and a poem there and so on. Mm. But she was the first book by a black woman. In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, Woman is Prose, was the first book I read by a black woman, like an entire book. And it was at a point where I was already self-identifying as feminist.
Yeah.
And it was just so incredibly important and precious.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, other feminists in the world have been incredibly important to me. Because I think that it's, yes, the personal is political, but part of the person, I mean, the personal is always in relation to others. And I think what's important also about discovering and constantly finding other feminists in the world is that it allows you to feel, on one level, it allows you to feel more okay about being yourself and your own contradictions and your own humanness and
your idiosyncrasies and everything.
And also about your voice and to be able to, and about what you like, about what you don't like, about what you agree with, about what you, you know, and it also, of course, is incredibly important for me, has been, I think it's important for all of us who are feminists, to be able to be part of a movement, right? To be able to be part of a movement. So it's incredibly important to me when I, your voice is incredibly important to me. Jessica Horn's voice is incredibly important to me. Bunima Tlanyane's voice is very important to me. So other African feminists and other feminists in the world are incredibly important to me because they allow, first of all, it is a movement and they allow me to feel a certain way about the world and they energize me in many ways to do, to contribute to that larger project and to recognize that that's a worthy project, that the risks are worth it, and that I'm okay.
It also brings that level of sanity because there's so much negative that, oh, you're a feminist, you this and this and this, but then in the broader aspect, it's like, okay, well, this is why we're doing it. I'm not alone in that
journey. But also just, you know what, I think many people who maybe don't self-identify as feminists or who are not sympathetic to feminism don't understand how much, yes, there's enormous anger, which is necessary because patriarchy is horrible.
Yeah.
But they also don't understand the absolute pleasure there is in watching someone who is so fully herself.
Yeah.
Who may not be exactly like you. So because you don't need other people to be exactly like you you know, just how freeing it is to watch someone do and say and live their life.
And feel.
And feel and speak. Even when you don't necessarily agree with every single thing that they're saying. Mm. But to be able, you know, there is such pleasure for me in feminism.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that often gets lost because, you know, it's very often, I mean, I suppose people who are patriarchal, who are antagonistic to feminism, think about how threatening it is to them, which it should be, right? Yeah. It is. It is threatening to patriarchy. It should be. That's why we are rogues.
Mm.
But yes, I mean, I think that the largest part for me is just how much pleasure I derive from feminist community.
Yeah. And whether it's within the community or whether it's alone or it's an afterthought. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a couple of years ago I was at a women's symposium and we had women from across Africa. In fact, from across the world. Mm-hmm. And I won't mention the country, but there was a country where the country had been banned from dancing. And at the end of our conference, we put on music. And these two women got up and they danced and we cried. But there was just joy in their faces. And we were crying because they knew that this was the only chance. And it's moments like that we realize, you know what, we've taken that step. You know, and also, I mean, for me is that, yes, the feminist movement and woman empowerment in South Africa, we've still got a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
But we are still like streams ahead compared to other communities.
Yes, absolutely. And also, of course, to see to continue to see very different kinds of feminine expression, right? Yeah. To see different kinds of feminists, to see different kinds of women break new ground is kind of constantly wonderful discovery.
Yeah, yeah. So now the book has been everywhere you look. Everyone wants a piece of the book. And you did a launch in Cape Town recently also, didn't you?
No, I haven't. The one you helped me do, the one you led was the only, has been the, we're doing open book in Cape Town.
Okay.
I think it's the 6th or the 7th. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But I mean, at open book from the 6th to the 10th.
Yeah.
So I'm doing various things. And one of those is the Cape Town launch.
Fantastic. Well, I know it's going to do incredibly well.
Oh, thank you.
And then also another exciting venture. I mean, you started off, I mean, you also grew up at Forte because your father was an academic. And I hear that you're going back.
I am.
in another position.
I am going back in another position. I mean, it's very exciting.
Mm.
It's a little nerve-wracking as well because Forte means so much to me.
Yeah.
You know, I think I would not have been to be... I'm very aware that in the South African Academy, you know, a black woman full professor is a very rare thing, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like we're in the single digits in most universities, except UNISA or Limpopo.
Mm.
But like in most universities, it's like one or two, that's just two of us, African, black, South African.
Mm.
And then, you know, just a handful if you use kind of black, more the more political, broad black. So, and often people say to me, well, you know, you must be some kind of Wonder Woman and da-da-da-da-da and, you know, the exceptionalist discourse. And I'm not, I mean, I don't want to completely not take credit for how hard I work. But at the same time, you know, it's institutional.
Yeah.
There's a reason, there's something that keeps people out. So it's not that the people who get in are not remarkable, but it's also that there are many other remarkable people that are able to be kind of locked out in very more effectively.
Yeah.
And so going to Forte is on the one hand, I feel like, well, I owe it all to Forte because I could take, whereas for many of us, black women in the academy, you have to constantly work against the communication that you don't belong there.
Yeah.
Whereas I grew up on a black university campus. And so I always had evidence of black intellectuals and black black people.
And also, I mean, more importantly, you understood the meaning behind the black power and struggle.
Absolutely.
You know, and I mentioned this also at the launch, was that was one of the challenges that I had to deal with growing up, and especially in my early 20s, was that what is black power? Mm. And really believing it and only understanding it much later in life, whereas it was there from the beginning.
Yes, it was given to me.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. And so now, but as part of that larger project of caring about the academy and of caring about black scholarship, about caring about decolonization, about seeing both the benefits and the limitations of transformation, and watching, you know, and being part of those conversations and those movements in the universities that I've been part of as an adult.
Yeah.
One of the things that's been very striking to many of us is the place of black institutions.
Mm.
Right. And the way and the very strange kind of irony of post-apartheid South Africa of seeing black universities fall apart almost. Be drained. They're not the places. And so we're thinking about so as committed as I am to kind of the decolonizing and transformation, project across the South African higher education landscape. I do think that we do need to invest differently in institutions like Forte, if we're serious about thinking about the place of black scholarship, if we're thinking about the entire landscape needs to be transformed, and the challenges are different at different places. And I've worked, you know, for most of all of my career at white institutions at Free State in the 90s and at Wits, entering as associate professor and then becoming full professor at Wits. So Forte is in some ways a return, you know, and of course, because it's Forte specifically, I feel incredibly grateful and loyal and romantic, probably, about it. But of course, I know that it's not, there will be challenges, and there'll be challenges of a kind that I can't even imagine now.
Yeah.
But I think it's worth it. And so I'll be entering, I'm moving to Forte as Dean of Research, because I do think that, you know, the knowledge revolution is absolutely something that we can't continue to, you know, to stay back from. So yes,
and I mean, also it's a bit of a shift now, but because of what's happening, especially in the media space, of this instant gratification, and in order to be acknowledged, you need to either have followers or need to be driving the right car, and it's moving away from the intellectual, it's moving away from the learning, from the education. And so I think that voice is incredibly important and exciting.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. And also, I just think that there's certain things we sometimes, where you are, where you're located, allows you to see and ask certain kinds of questions. And so I think there's place. I think there's room for different kinds of institutions. Mm. And I think certain questions are best asked or are possible. I think there are opportunities at every institution to ask different kinds of questions, to invest in certain kinds of, and I think that, you know, the questions and needs and innovations and so on.
Yeah.
And I think that we sometimes are so fixated on the problem that we don't think about what the opportunities are.
That's so true.
And so I would like, I suppose, I feel like going to Forte for me feels like a paying back the huge debt that I feel. Because of the enormous amount that I think I benefited from having been raised at Forte, but it also feels like being part of a team that's building something.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to do anything on my own, but I'm incredibly optimistic about some of the people that are there and some of the people that are moving there. And I want to be part of building something. And I think that one of the benefits of being the anomaly of a full professor at 44 is that I can consider this.
Mm.
I can consider this now, and it's not like I'm not still building my career. In that sense. But it also means, of course, that I have had access to a whole range of insights into the into the academy at different institutions, and I understand the landscape in a different way than I might have if I'd moved there if I'd moved there in a more kind of conventional academic capacity, or if I'd moved there at a more junior level.
Yeah.
So we're hoping. I mean, I'm very energized by some of the work that the new VC at Forte, Professor Sakela Buhlungu, has already kind of started putting in place. So I'm looking forward to being part of a team that builds and shifts.
Yeah, things. Taking it to the next level
and maximizing what works. Yeah. Of course, you know. Yeah. So it's not a paternalistic, we are all going there to go change things. it's recognizing that many things work there, but how to the building is maximizing what works, but also perhaps thinking about, well, if we come from different experiences and different institutional knowledges, how can we do certain things differently in a way that contributes to
and,
that
and what
project.
Shifts are actually needed. Yeah,
absolutely.
And writing, what's next in the books? I know that the autobiography is not going to happen. So. Where are we moving to next? Because, I mean, I didn't mention in the beginning, I mean, the book was published by Melinda Ferguson, who everybody knows. And, I mean, you two are just the rock star duo. What any ideas that you have for future books?
Well, thank you, Rosie. Yes, actually, the next book I'm doing is not for Melinda. It's a book that was commissioned by a different press. It's part of a series called Voices of Liberation. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing a biography of Miriam Tladi, the black consciousness, black feminist, novelist, essayist, short story writer, who died earlier this year. She was the first black woman to publish a novel in English inside the country.
Yeah.
She was the most prolific writer of the black consciousness generation.
Mm.
She was a fierce, fierce feminist, both in terms of what she wrote, but also in terms of how she related to other and shared space and brought, you know, other women and cared about why there weren't more black women writing and it was cheeky and weird and wonderful. And I had the great pleasure of meeting her several times.
Oh, wow.
So that's what I'm working on. I've been fixated on her for many years. I've probably taken too long to write it. But that's the project
that's
I'm working on now.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping to do it to at least send it over to the publisher before I start at Forte.
Yeah. Well, when exactly are you starting it?
January.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
And then we'll see. I mean, I don't. You know, there's a few ideas about other things to do, but I think that the big shift, the big move, is going to probably influence how I write.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because I am moving into a job that requires different kinds of physical presence from me on campus. So I'm going to have to revise how I write a little bit.
Yeah, and probably also different environment and everything else. Mm. And well, we wish you the best of luck. And how do we get hold of your books? MF Books?
They are at all the major booksellers. Mm-hmm. So they're the exclusive books. They are at all your indie bookshops. So they're at Love Books and Shara in Joburg. Mm. They're at Protea in Joburg, in Pretoria and Bloemfontein and PE. They are in African Flavor Books in the Vaal. They
Beautiful.
Are at
across the board.
They all over Cape Town. So yes, I mean, and if you can't find them, order them.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for
having
me.
Look forward to this time next year and your journey into your next space. So, but thank you for your writing and your honesty, because at the end of the day, that's what it's about. So thank you.
Thank you, Rosie.
Of course, that was the rock star of authors, Pumla, who was in the studio with me. If you want more information on how to get hold of her books, on just looking into the other books that she's written, of course, look at my Facebook page, or my Twitter page, my Instagram page, Rosie Mutena across the board, or drop me an email, rosie@rosiemutena.biz. Thank you so much for listening. CliffCentral.com.